Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Consumer surveys show that up to 75% of Americans take dietary supplements. While supplements can assist patients in reaching recommended daily intake of vitamins and minerals, it is important for healthcare providers to understand when and in which patients it is appropriate, as well as the effects of abnormal levels of vitamins and minerals and potential drug-nutrient interactions. Today, Dr. Linda Huang, an ambulatory care clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, will discuss just that.
So in today's day and age, patients are exposed to a variety of health-related information, be it from news articles, online stories, or from friends and family. Patients have the ability to make choices regarding the over-the-counter vitamins and supplements that they are willing to take. But as a healthcare provider, when a patient comes to you and tells you, "Oh, I'm just taking a few vitamins," can we really take that at face value? So in today's presentation, I want to discuss the effects of a patient choosing their own over-the-counter supplements and some of the potential effects of having abnormal levels of those select vitamins and minerals. Also to look at some of the recent evidence and literature on the effects of supplementation and to highlight some of the potential drug-nutrient interactions that occur between vitamins and minerals and commonly prescribed medications. So here I have a patient medication list. When I do medication reconciliation, I have patients who come in with pages upon pages of different medications, and they ask me to find different medication problems or ways that we could decrease the pill burden for these patients. And looking at a list, this list as a healthcare provider, do you see any problems with it? Well, for me and my training, my eye gets caught by quite a few medications here immediately. I see this interesting acetaminophen dose, which if I want to investigate whether the patient is using it appropriately, as they could easily be taking too high levels of acetaminophen. And then as I keep looking through the list, I see here that the patient's on an ACE and an ARB, and I will spend time looking into why the patient's doing that. And the problems just keep coming. Here's a metformin dose that is higher than that's typically recommended. I see an issue with sismetoprol dose. I see a near therapeutic index drug. And all of these are things that I would take the time to discuss with my patient. However, at this point, if the patient tells you, "Oh, I want to take some more vitamins," depending on the amount of time you have with the patient, sometimes this may not be able to be addressed. And also, how much do we really know of what to address with the patient? Well, vitamins and mineral supplementation are used by a majority of Americans. Over 75% of U.S. adults report that they use a vitamin or supplement. And reasons for using supplementation vary by age group. However, you can see generally patients expect overall wellness as the reason why they're using vitamins and supplements. However, they may also have some expectations regarding what supplements could do for them, such as for energy, bone health, heart health, etc. Not as commonly seen is that they're using the vitamins to fill nutrient gaps, which is technically the reason why vitamins and supplements exist. However, vitamins are not harmless. In 2017, around 60,000 vitamin-related medication exposures were called in to the poison centers, and around 3,500 of these exposures had to be treated in a healthcare facility. Though through the way that the poison center documents, it's hard to determine whether or not there was another medication involved in these exposures reactions, but I would like to point out that there were 6 major reactions and 1 death associated with vitamins, and that 1 death, in case you were wondering, was a result of a vitamin D overdose. And the poison centers report that vitamins are one of the categories of medications that they see an increase yearly increase in the number of major reactions and deaths associated with it. And due to this, the FDA has some upcoming labeling regulation changes. By the year 2021, but has already been occurring if you look at your supplement or food labels, vitamins A, D, and E will be converted from international units to these new units seen on this slide. And when we go through the presentation and go more in depth into these vitamins, we will explain a little bit of why these changes will be occurring. So vitamin A, D, and E are all fat-soluble vitamins, and typically we think of fat-soluble vitamins as having a certain level of danger in having high levels as they can accumulate the human body. So we will talk about this category of vitamins first. Vitamin A comes in two forms. One is the provitamin A, which comes from plant sources such as orange and yellow vegetables. And the other form is the pre-vitamin A, which comes from more meat-related sources, and such as liver and fish oils. And if you looked at the recommended dietary allowance, there's actually quite a big range between what is recommended intake and the tolerable upper intake levels through the recommendations. However, it is relatively easy to supplement vitamin A in the typical American diet. For example, one sweet potato can give us around 500% the recommended dietary allowance, and one serving of beef liver would be around 400%. In this regard, vitamin A levels is typically rare in the United States, but it would be seen in premature infants, malnutrition, or patients who are coming from third world countries, and in patients with cystic fibrosis. But vitamin A at toxicity levels could have quite severe symptoms. But however, the plant-sourced or beta-carotene types of vitamin A are not typically associated with toxicity. At high levels, the most we're most likely to see is just the patient having orange skin. Well, but in terms of the preformed vitamin A or the ones from meat sources, if that is the type a patient is eating or supplementing, then we can see toxicity symptoms. And the most common story that this resulted from was from polar explorers who out of necessity had to eat polar bear and seal livers and overdosed on vitamin A accordingly. And toxicity symptoms that are seen include teratogenicity, increased intracranial pressures, and mucocutaneous abnormalities. There are some health modifications that are linked to vitamin A. There were several large studies that looked at vitamin A in relation to cancer risk, and what they found was that in men with a history of smoking, there were higher incidence of lung and aggressive prostate cancer. Another study that followed physicians who took supplements found that vitamin A in these patients did not have a similar effect, and that was associated with the fact that only 11% of physicians were smokers. So this could be a population that should not be supplementing vitamin A. Another news story from a recent 2019 article that was going around is that vitamin A can reduce the incidence of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And that's what the headlines of many news stories might say that are targeting towards patients. However, if you read the news story and the article or the research article, it states that this reduced incidence is solely from a dietary source of vitamin A, and the authors could not conclude whether or not supplementation would have any effect on this incidence. Another common association of vitamin A and a health disease is eye health. And the AREDS trial found that vitamins A, C, E, zinc, and copper could help reduce the progression to macular degeneration. However, the more recent AREDS 2 trial found that beta-carotene or vitamin A is not helpful, and there are other beta-carotenoids that are more likely to be beneficial in this population. So that's a very weak link between vitamin A supplementation and macular degeneration. Lastly, vitamin A has been shown to lower bone mineral density at levels above the recommended dietary allowance. So that's another shaky population when people are choosing to supplement vitamin A. The next vitamin I wanted to talk about was vitamin E. Vitamin E in the U.S. diet typically results from nuts and seeds, but more often the vegetable oils that patients might be ingesting. Vitamin A comes in natural form. It's only one form, the alpha tocopherol form, but as a synthetic form, it could come as a various number of isostereomers, but only the alpha tocopherol form is the one that the human body can absorb. And due to that confusion between where the vitamin E is coming from, the FDA has recommended that now we're measuring all vitamin E by milligrams of alpha tocopherol, so the amount that the human body can actually absorb. And these are the new recommended dietary allowances, which, as you can see, similar to vitamin A, range quite widely from the tolerable upper intake levels recommended. Vitamin E deficiency is rare in the United States as well, but is seen in patients with problems with absorbing vitamin E, such as those with fat malabsorption disorders, Crohn's disease, cystic fibrosis, or an inability to secrete bile from the liver. And the results of vitamin E deficiency include peripheral neuropathy, myopathy, and impaired immune response. However, if vitamin E is taken at high levels, toxicities include inhibiting of platelet aggregation and at long-term chronic toxicity levels, increasing the risk of hemorrhagic strokes. Vitamin E has been associated with an increased risk of prostate cancer. Also, when looking at vitamin E in relation to cognitive impairment, a Cochrane systematic review found that there's no evidence that supplementing vitamin E improves cognitive impairment or prevents progression from cognitive impairment to Alzheimer's disease. However, there were some moderate evidence that it may slow the functional decline in Alzheimer's disease. Another population that could benefit from vitamin E modification is patients taking high doses of antipsychotics. Another Cochrane review found that there is some evidence that vitamin E supplementation may prevent tardive dyskinesia in patients who take antipsychotics. However, this was only in a prophylaxis setting. If a patient already has tardive dyskinesia, the vitamin E supplement is not likely to help them. Also, interestingly, in a meta-analysis that took many of these vitamin E-related trials and combined the and looked at the overall mortality risk, there was an increased mortality risk in patients who took supplementation of vitamin E at doses as low as 400 international units or around 200 milligrams versus those who took placebo. And unfortunately, that is the common dose of vitamin E that is found in supplementation on the market currently. Next vitamin is vitamin D, which might be a vitamin we're all more familiar with since it does come in a prescription form. But for the purposes of today's presentation, we're going to focus on it more as an over-the-counter supplementation product. Vitamin D is rarely found in the typical United States diet. So when we think of it coming from sun exposure. And though we may recommend high doses of vitamin D, the recommended dietary allowance is actually pretty low for a healthy, otherwise healthy adult. Vitamin D is one of the vitamins that we're able to take serum concentrations to test the levels for deficiency or toxicity. And here are some of the different levels in relation to what it means for vitamin D. Vitamin D does not have a linear relationship with the concentration levels, but on average, around 40 international units or 1 milligram of vitamin D can raise the level by around 1 to 2 nanomoles per liter. Abnormal vitamin D levels can cause a variety of different diseases. Deficiencies can occur in patients who have limited sun exposure or have dark skin, breastfeeding infants, obese individuals, and those with fat malabsorption disorders. The most common effects we see here are rickets and osteomalacia. On the toxicity side, however, it really manifests as very nonspecific symptoms, such as anorexia, weight loss, polyuria, and heart arrhythmias. But due to the effects that vitamins have as a hormonal regulator in the body, it leads to hypercalcemia and more serious effects, such as vascular and tissue calcification. When we think about vitamin D, often we think of it in relation to bone health. Well, for osteoporosis, it's important to note that there's a greater risk of frailty and decreased bone mineral density if the levels are both low or high. So having patients take too much vitamin D might not be helping them for this disease state. Also, the USPSTF had recent recommendations that there's no benefit if vitamin D levels of 400 units or less for primary prevention. So in healthy older adults who have otherwise no vitamin D deficiencies or risk for osteoporosis, there's really no need to low-dose supplement this population. Vitamin D has been tested in a variety of clinical trials, and recently it was found that it does not decrease cardiovascular outcomes or cancer risk. However, one place where vitamin D has found a place outside of osteoporosis is that a meta-analysis found reduced rates of moderate to severe COPD exacerbations if vitamin D is supplemented in those with already low levels. So at this point, I have a checkpoint question. A patient is on aspirin and clopidogrel. She also has a medication list that includes a multivitamin, the AREDS2 eye vitamin, and immune health booster that upon looking further at the label, it was high-dose vitamin E. Which of the following symptoms could be attributed to her vitamin intake? And with a show of hands in the audience, how many think it's A, orange skin, B, gum bleeding, C, peripheral neuropathy, or D, impaired blood glucose control? Like the majority of the room stated, the correct answer is B, gum bleeding. High-dose vitamin E has been associated with bleeding risks such as inhibited platelet aggregation, and at doses such as this with the high-dose vitamin E in combinations with the vitamin E content of the multivitamin AREDS2, we might even be thinking at risk of hemorrhagic stroke in this patient. And it's important to note the side effects of vitamins, because in this case, we may have thought that her aspirin and clopidogrel were giving her gum bleeding, and we might have stopped one of these medications that actually has a known benefit to the patient's disease state, as opposed to just stopping her vitamin E supplementation first. The next category of vitamins I want to talk about are the water-soluble vitamins. Vitamin B comes as a variety of different sources, and here's just a list of the various members of the family and their names that they are referred to as. Vitamin B deficiency can be caused by a number of different illnesses or state of health, and the effects that we see from vitamin D deficiency ranges widely from CNS effects such as Wernicke's encephalopathy or peripheral neuropathy, cardiovascular effects such as beriberi, which can cause shortness of breath and increased pulse, or even things related to skin and hair issues and metabolic insufficiencies. But however, vitamin B toxicity could occur when supplemented. So generally, there is no upper limit. There are two that I want to point out do have an upper limit. Paradoxine has been shown at both low and high levels to cause peripheral neuropathy, and folate at high levels can mask a vitamin B12 or cyanocobalamin insufficiency. So how this would work was if a patient is taking high dose of the folate but not enough cyanocobalamin, the folate will actually reverse the macrocytic anemia on lab tests, but it will not reverse the peripheral neuropathy caused by cyanocobalamin deficiency, and therefore the patient might continue to have vitamin B deficiency that might not be tested for. The other thing I want to note is that high biotin levels have been associated with interactions with hormonal lab tests at doses as low as 10 milligrams, which when I found out this, I looked at my multivitamin and that's the dose that's in it. So what they found was that there could be decreased TSH, NT-proBNP, and troponin levels associated with doses of biotin taken within hours of the lab test. There's actually one case study of a patient who was incorrectly diagnosed with Graves' disease due to having high biotin supplementation right before they took their lab test. And another case of a patient whose myocardial infarction was actually ignored due to the decreased troponins that was found when they took the lab test. But vitamin B is not without its benefits. Paradoxine has shown benefits for mood symptoms in PMS, but not for the physical symptoms. Riboflavin at high doses of 400 milligrams or more a day have been shown to be effective as migraine prophylaxis. Cyanocobalamin deficiency have been associated with Alzheimer's disease. However, there's no association between supplementation and for non-deficient patients as a benefit in this population. And another interesting study looked at a combination of different vitamin Bs and a vitamin B supplement and found that when taken, it decreased homocysteine levels and risk of stroke in this population. But due to the way it was tested, it's hard to know which of these vitamin B could have contributed to this benefit. Another water-soluble vitamin that we'll talk about today is vitamin C. When we think about vitamin C deficiency, we think about explorers on ships having scurvy. And in today's day and age, it's relatively hard to get scurvy, but it could happen in populations in individuals exposed to cigarette smoke, and this includes secondhand smokers, and in patients with end-stage renal disease. And here, the symptoms of scurvy or vitamin C deficiency includes fatigue and malaise, impaired connective tissues, depression, and anemia. However, on the other hand, toxicity is relatively difficult in vitamin C, as through oral supplementation from an over-the-counter setting, the body very tightly controls plasma concentrations of vitamin C. So when taken orally, the maximum concentration is around 220 micromoles per liter and not really associated with any symptoms. However, in an IV formulation, the concentrations could go as high as 26,000 micromoles per liter. And this might be the area where in the acute care setting, there has been more benefits found, and also where toxicities might be worrisome. The one thing I do want to point out is that there is a current fashion trend where patients are receiving IV vitamins in the community. The one article that I found was patients would receive a proprietary blend of vitamin B, C, magnesium, and amino acids. So in this setting, we might be worried about patients showing up with vitamin C toxicities. What vitamin C supplementation is often associated with is the common cold. And there is a Cochrane review that states vitamin C supplementation reduces duration of colds by 8% in adults and 13% in children. However, it's not stated at what dose or whether continuous prophylaxis throughout the year would be beneficial for these populations. Vitamin C has also been associated with an increased overall mortality rate in postmenopausal women with coronary stenosis. But on the other hand, in a malnourished population, it was found to have a reduced risk of cerebrovascular deaths. One thing to point out is that for both of these studies, the vitamin C was conducted with other minerals and supplements as well. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly where what is contributory from the vitamin C versus the other vitamins that were tested for. An interesting role that vitamin C has in over-the-counter supplementation is in post-operative analgesia. A study found that there was decreased analgesia use in patients who took vitamin C 500 milligrams twice daily as opposed to placebo. And since vitamin C is a relatively inexpensive medication, this could be a role that we see vitamin C take further down the road as more studies come out. Now moving on to a few select minerals. The first one I want to talk about is calcium. Calcium is something we see a lot of supplementation for. And here mostly I want to point out that the recommended dietary allowance for calcium, it's not that high. And the tolerable upper intake levels are pretty closely linked to the dietary allowance. And when we are recommending supplementation, that absorption of calcium is highest in doses of less than 500 milligrams. So a patient is taking a calcium tablet, three tablets at a time, they're probably not getting much benefit from that supplementation. And it's also important to note which formulation of calcium the patient is taking. Calcium carbonate is more frequently seen on the market, but it's absorbed most efficiently when taken with food or not in the setting of acid suppression therapy. Otherwise, patients might benefit more from calcium citrate. But I also want to bring to your attention that calcium supplementation does not come without risks. Once the meta-analysis found that there was an increased risk of myocardial infarctions in patients who took calcium supplements versus placebo, and there's no really known reason why, and this is something that more research is needed in. Another risk for patients is that there's an increased risk of kidney stones when calcium is taken with or without vitamin D. When looking at a group of postmenopausal nurses, doses of vitamin D at 1,000 milligrams of calcium and 400 units of vitamin D have shown a 17% increase in kidney stones. So if your patient comes with a history of kidney stones, it might be well worth your time to see what supplementations they're taking. The other mineral I want to address in today's presentation is zinc. Zinc is a supplement we now see a lot on the markets, and it comes from a dietary source that's relatively frequently seen in the U.S. Population. Oysters and shellfish have the highest amount of zinc, but red meat, eating red meat and poultry easily could get you to your recommended dietary allowance of zinc. Take eating just two beef hamburger patties would give you your recommended dietary allowance for a typical U.S. adult. And though we see a wide range between the recommended allowances and the tolerable upper intake levels, it's quite likely in today's population that we have patients who meet this level. But patients who are at risk for deficiencies would be those who are not eating meats and poultry, such as vegetarians, or in patients who have disease states that have them with a problem with absorbing zinc, such as breastfeeding women and infants, sickle cell disease, and liver disease. And signs of zinc deficiencies include growth retardation, loss of appetite, and impaired immune function. But when patients are supplementing on top of a healthy diet, it might lead them to more of a toxicity setting, where we can see in an acute setting that would be nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, and headaches. Or in long-term toxicity could lead to decreased copper absorption or altered iron function, resulting in anemia, or reduced levels of HDL in these patients. A reason why zinc is frequently advertised on the market is in regards to the common cold. And there is evidence from a Cochrane systematic review that found that zinc reduces duration and severity of the common cold if administered within 24 hours of onset of symptoms. But in adults, there is no reason to supplement zinc throughout the year for the pure purposes of the common cold. In children, zinc has, as prophylaxis for over 5 months, have been shown to reduce the cold incidence. However, there is little information on what doses of zinc are appropriate, so it's very important if patients are using this as a benefit, looking at their diet and making sure they're not reaching toxicity levels. Another place where zinc has been helpful is in liver disease. Patients with hepatitis C and cirrhosis, it was found that the patients who responded appropriately to zinc therapy had better long-term outcomes. But since this was just one randomized control study, it's hard to say whether or not the rest of the patients would have improved outcomes if they just gave a higher dose of zinc than that was studied. Now I have another checkpoint question for everyone. So a patient comes to you stating that he saw an online article that there were recent studies that vitamins can prevent cancer, but he doesn't know which one. Which of the following vitamin and minerals have shown benefits in cancer risk? With a show of hands, is it A, vitamin A and squamous cell carcinoma, B, vitamin D and prostate cancer, C, vitamin E and lung cancer, or D, calcium and breast cancer? All right, so not that I expected anyone to know all of the benefits of vitamins off the top of their head, but the one that is correct here is A, vitamin A and squamous cell carcinoma. And the reason why I pointed this one out is that the patient read that vitamin A could help with squamous cell carcinoma. And this might be something that he's very interested in. But talking to this patient through why he thinks he would need vitamin A supplementation and telling him that the only benefit seen here was from dietary supplementation and maybe pointing him to healthy foods or to a nutritionist for that benefit. Lastly, I wanted to discuss some of the common drug-nutrient interactions that can be seen with supplementation. So there is a common saying that if a vitamin or herbal supplement works really well, we make it into a prescription drug. And that's what happened with vitamin A. Retinoids could come in topical, oral, or IV formulations. But however, realizing that they are forms of vitamin A, and if additional vitamin A supplementation is given on top of it, we're putting the patient at an increased risk for hypervitaminosis A. Cholestyramine and orlistat are two medications that can decrease absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. So it might be beneficial for patients with these medications to take a multivitamin apart from the ingestion of the medications in order to prevent deficiencies. Anti-epileptic steroids and statins, except for fluvastatin, have been shown to decrease vitamin D levels. So in patients who are on these medications, it may be advisable to check a vitamin D level at the start of these medications. There are many drugs that decrease vitamin B levels, and for thiamine, furosemide, and naloxone have both been shown to cause thiamine deficiencies. What is really interesting is that thiamine deficiency is linked with left ventricular ejection fraction deficiencies as well. So it's interesting that both of these medications are used for heart failure, but also may cause thymine deficiencies, which then related to heart failure. Methotrexate, its mechanism of action is a folate antagonist. But when patients are supplementing folate over the counter, they might be taking a formulation called folinolic acid, or you may better know as leucovorin. So we will be worried about the efficacy of methotrexate if a patient is taking high doses of folate, especially in its leucovorin form. Sulfasalazine and antiepileptics have also been shown to decrease folate levels. Paradoxine has had some research show that it might be a hormonal regulator, and the current hormone is most linked to was estrogen. So patients who are taking oral contraceptives or estrogen replacement therapy might see low paradoxine levels. And lastly, metformins, PPI, and H2RAs all interact with the absorption of cyanocobalamin, so low vitamin B12 levels could be seen in populations who take these medications. There are also drugs that can decrease minerals. Aluminum and magnesium-containing antacids and mineral oil and stimulant laxative decrease the absorption and excretion, an increased excretion of calcium. Corticosteroids also have a role in depleting calcium storage in a patient. For zinc, ACE inhibitors have been shown to bind to zinc, therefore not allowing the body to absorb zinc appropriately, and thiazide diuretics could increase zinc excretion by up to 60%. So when we talk about supplementation of zinc, these two patients who are using these two medications long term might benefit from supplementation. We talk about a lot of medications that decrease vitamin levels. However, it could also happen the opposite way, where the vitamins could interact with drugs. Vitamin E has been shown to interact with anticoagulation and antiplatelet effects due to the increased bleeding levels. In warfarin patients, it's advisable to monitor when the vitamin E dose is above 400 milligrams. There's conflicting evidence on whether or not this will increase the INR or simply increase the patient's risk of bleeding in another form. Antioxidants such as vitamin C and vitamin E, when given in combination with simvastatin and niacin, have been shown to have a less decreased increase in HDL. So patients will not have as much benefit in their HDL elevations and if they're also taking antioxidants. Folic acid has been shown to decrease levels of phenytoin and also decrease the seizure control of phenytoin independently of levels. So this is an interaction that you might want to be careful if a patient is taking antiepileptics. And paradoxine also has an effect on antiepileptics. It's been shown to decrease levels of phosphenytoin, phenytoin, and phenobarbital. So if a patient is taking a high-dose vitamin B supplement, you might want to watch out a little for some of these antiepileptic interactions. So now my last checkpoint question for everyone. Which of the following is a known drug-nutrient interaction? Is it A, cholestyramine and vitamin C, B, phenytoin and calcium, C, metformin and vitamin B12, and D, hydrochlorothiazide and folic acid? So the majority of the room picked metformin and vitamin B12. It's a commonly known association that metformin decreases vitamin B12, but there's no recommendations on when and how to take vitamin B12 levels. So this is something that you may have to think about in the patient and what other symptoms that they may be showing on whether or not that is appropriate. So now going back to this patient medication list that we saw at the beginning of the presentation, we know about some of these prescription medication problems, but at the end of this presentation, I hope you'll notice that the patient are also taking some supplementation that we might want to discuss with them, such as why does the patient think that they need to take a high-dose vitamin A, and what is actually in the vitamin A? Is it a preformed vitamin A product, which is dangerous, versus a provitamin A product, which might not be? Patient is also taking biotin gummies. And we see that the patient is also on levothyroxine. So could it be possible that they were taking high dose of biotin prior to their TSH level, so we're not correctly dosing their levothyroxine? And there's also calcium and D vitamins. So thinking about what population is this patient in? Do they really need supplementation? And are they at an increased risk for kidney stones? And also another one you might see is folic acid and phenytoin, which we discussed that there might be interaction there, and whether or not that that folic acid is important enough, and if we stopped it, would we have better seizure control in this patient? And also want to point out that if the patient's telling you they're taking additional vitamins, to really ask them to bring in those bottles or to tell you more about them, because we're not sure if there are additional drug interactions that are leading to this list, or they're taking levels of different vitamins that combine are creating toxic levels in this patient, which may manifest as symptoms that we can't otherwise identify from solely prescription medications. So my takeaway point for everyone in this presentation, as I know I've given a lot of information, is that vitamins are not harmless. There are risks associated with its use, especially when we're seeing toxic levels or in terms of drug interactions. And it's important to question patients on why they are taking vitamins. Vitamins can lead to an increased pill burden, which might lead to patients not being adherent to their prescription medications. It might also create a financial burden. But most importantly, to discuss with them what are their expectations from their vitamins and whether or not they're taking it safely and with if there's any evidence that we can use to back them up for their use of that supplement. And lastly, as a healthcare provider, I hope you'll look for drug-nutrient interactions to determine if there's need for supplementation or further testing for the patient to assure them that we are taking care of them safely and effectively.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.